Hello and welcome back. My name is Luke and you're listening to another episode of the Next Stage podcast. People are getting paid in it, and governments are regulating it. Blockchain is officially mainstream. How did this happen, and what does it mean? While blockchain enthusiasts have been bullish the past few years, signs of a recent collapse have many re-examining this technology. Nicholas Carey, co-founder and vice chairman of blockchain.com, is an early blockchain adopter. Having snapped up the blockchain.com domain more than 10 years ago, here he shares his insights on the road ahead, from fintechs to sports sponsorships.
Thank you so much for coming out to see us today, or to see this gentleman in particular. I wanted to start things off with a little bit of audience engagement here. We're going to do an icebreaker, and I want to give you guys a choice what that icebreaker is going to be. Do you want to hear the story about Nick's talk with the European Parliament or how he got kicked by a horse? Horse? All right. Real quick, Nick, how did you get kicked by a horse?
So I may or may not have a broken arm this morning, but on Sunday I was in Colorado and I was celebrating my bachelor party with some of my friends, and there was a horse involved, but it just kicked me. And hopefully it's okay, but I'm very happy to be here with all of you, and I'm going to bring my A game to this discussion.
We're glad you survived.
Yeah, thank you.
For those of you who don't know, Nick is the co-founder and CEO of a company called Blockchain.com. Blockchain.com is kind of difficult to describe. It doesn't fit into a lot of the corporate boxes that we check when we talk about companies. So I wanted to kick things off just by having you quickly give us an overview. So first of all, what is blockchain.com? And then I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about how your vision for what it is has changed over the years from when you founded it to today.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. I'm so excited to be here. I want to thank the Web Summit team and crew. It's a monster effort to put this together, and for everyone for coming out, for teaching each other and sharing ideas, celebrating everyone building things is one of the things I love to spend my time doing. At blockchain.com, we founded the company over 10 years ago, and the one thing all the founders had in common was sort of a mutual interest in statistics. And so we built something called a Block Explorer, which was a search engine for looking at the time at the Bitcoin blockchain. We wanted to see whether or not there was economic activity. We wanted to better understand the data heuristics, and we learned that people were actually using it. So we got excited about participating in building more tools for the cryptocurrency community. And the first thing we decided to do was build a wallet. A wallet is a really key piece of software infrastructure in that market. And since then, we've had over 85 million people sign up to use the blockchain.com wallet. It's completely free, and you can download it from the App Store, and we have users in over 200 countries. Since then, we've been building. And if anyone hasn't been paying attention, obviously the global markets have been extraordinarily volatile this year on the macro level and then also in the crypto space. For us, this is the seventh time in 10 years I have seen a fairly big correction. Yeah. And happy to talk about that. But the big story in all of that is, throughout the ebbs and flows, those that you will experience in your lives and across your careers, it's important to build. Constantly keep building and listening to your customers. And that's one of the things we did. So the wallet sort of started our journey, and it sort of evolved into a passport to the future of financial services. We just started with Bitcoin, then we added Ethereum, we added a lot more digital assets, now we have hundreds, and we are building a capability to do everything from store your digital collectibles in your wallet, to digital identity, to stable coins, to much more, and hopefully build that accessible tool for anybody, regardless of their circumstances of their birth, to be able to send, receive, secure, trade, and exchange digital forms of wealth.
And we've seen a lot in the news lately about some exchanges suffering some financial difficulties, having to do a lot of layoffs. These are what we call in industry centralized exchanges as opposed to decentralized exchanges. And the centralized exchanges are taking custody of the assets for their users, their customers. From early on, blockchain.com was founded a little bit differently than that. Can you talk to us just a little bit about sort of the difference between self-custody and centralized custody and how that is playing into some of the spillover effects that we're seeing today?
Yeah, this is really important to understand. The promise of Bitcoin originally was to build a peer-to-peer electronic cash system for the internet. So basically making it possible for anybody to send precious information without having to rely on an intermediary, a custodian, or a counterparty. And so building tools that are non-custodial, like the purse you might have or the wallet in your back pocket, where you can store different types of features, whether that's an identity, a credit system, a cash instrument, a collectible, a ticket to a venue. All those things fit neatly in your wallet. And the promise of using decentralized ledgers is that anyone can access these systems on a global basis. What's happened, though, in our industry is some individuals and entities have actually re-centralized custody and ownership over user data, user funds. Now, if done properly with a high degree of security, that can work. But it's also sort of antithetical to the whole point of this thing. And so we are seeing hubris, and we're seeing a lack of fiduciary duty in some of these centralized entities, which is causing some contagion in the market today. In the long run, I think the promise of decentralization is something that's inherent in our company's DNA. We have employees in 50 countries around the world serving users in over 200, and building tools that enable individuals to be sovereign over their ownership of their wealth is still critically important to our business.
We hear a lot of talk about how centralization, about how letting a third party take custody of our assets might be a secret to institutional adoption. It might be the kind of safety blanket that big companies need in order to get involved. And there's a lot of really positive spin out there about this act of letting other people take custody over your assets. As a Bitcoin OG, I think the fact that his company has the blockchain.com domain is evidence of how long he's been around. How have you seen that change over the years? I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about the ideology of crypto, how it's evolved from when you first started to today, and whether or not it's a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah, so in the early days, there were really just some cryptographers, computer scientists, and individuals interested in distributed computing kind of participating and talking about these ideas on web forums. Then they started building things, and there have been sort of waves of adoption over the past decade. And so the earliest ones were very nerdy, and then it started to kind of cross that chasm a little more slowly. And we've really sort of seen four significant adoption curves. There was one in 2013, one in 2015, one in 2017, and then most recently in 2020. And each time one of those waves has come, between 2 and 10 times the previous number of network participants joins and signs up for services like ours and our competitors. And most recently, we saw roughly 100 new million market participants join the crypto community. And so we're getting to a point now where we are genuinely crossing the chasm into mainstream, and it's not just something for some internet nerds. And I'm really excited about that, because that is going to really bring a whole bunch of new exciting features, use cases, and business models that all of you guys can potentially participate in. And so we're at this moment.
But what's the but?
The but is we probably have another decade of building, and that's okay. I think if we're, you know, at 20% adoption of crypto in the United States, based on some fuzzy math there, roughly 1 in 5 people have either bought crypto or have some exposure to it. We have a long way to go, and so we're committed to building for the long duration, but I think the rest of the community needs to be concentrating on building resilient systems that are very useful for regular people.
What about this concept of centralization? It's kind of a difficult one to weave as a for-profit company. When you see some of your competitors putting giant ads out there at the Super Bowl, putting their logos on Major League Baseball umpire uniforms.
Yeah, if you haven't noticed, there's a lot of spending on the marketing happening right now, which is one way to do demand generation. But we've always felt it's best when your customers basically recommend you to their friends and family. The centralization thing is a bit concerning longer term, but I think the pendulum is swinging back in the direction of decentralization. The large internet platforms that we all relied on to basically build our current set of businesses, things like Twitter and Facebook and Amazon, we're seeing some of the ills of those large centralized databases of people's behavior, of their personal identifying information. We have concerns about how that is being used in our democratic processes and much more. And so returning ownership over your data and how you behave on the internet, I think, is extraordinarily important. Now, it's really sort of an internet generational thing. We're all sort of learning how the internet is changing the way our societies are shaped, and we can make corrections. And so heading in the direction of decentralization, personal empowerment, self-sovereignty over your information and how you use it and who you share it with is extremely powerful and super important for us.
So you were one of the companies that made a big investment recently in a sponsorship deal. tell us a little bit about that and why. I think that there was an initial sort of like reaction of enthusiasm. I think this is really cool. And then there was some, after people sat and thought for a while, a little skepticism about all of a sudden seeing these crypto company logos all over the place. Like, what is the sponsorship that you guys made recently? And so, like, yeah. What role do you see that playing, not just in the development of blockchain.com, but in the industry, generally speaking?
Well, I think there's a huge opportunity for mainstream brands to basically harness some of the cool capabilities of blockchain technology to have new ways of interacting with their customers. And so we recently announced a partnership with the Dallas Cowboys. It was the first with the NFL. It was a very complicated negotiation. And the reason we did it was because they are the premier brands in the NFL. They have the largest fan base internationally and are one of the most valuable sports franchises in the world. And so being with a mission-aligned, values-aligned organization with our brand and then implementing some technology over the coming years is going to be extraordinarily fun for the fans, and it's going to bring a whole bunch of new adopters into crypto. A fun fact, before we did that, we did them surveying with the Dallas Cowboys community. 54% of that fan base in the NFL believes that crypto will play some role in the future of their financial services. And so if that's any indicator of the direction of travel for more adoption, we want to be with those brands and with those leaders that have a winning tradition. And so that's why we got involved with the Dallas Cowboys.
There is something different there, I think, when a crypto company gets into sort of mainstream sponsorships like that. If I see a major credit card company sponsoring a golf event, I just think about them trying to get access to the viewers. But when I see a cryptocurrency company making a big sponsorship, there's a bit of a tinge of evangelism, even in that very act. Like, do you see these big investments as sort of a way to show these giant brands that there is value in crypto? And if so, like, what role do you see companies like your own and other well-funded exchanges in building those bridges between old school brands and the future?
Yeah, so look, I think there are definitely some vanity purchases where someone buys stadium rights and it's really expensive, and that's just a branding thing. That is not what we're trying to do. We're trying to create new, unique fan experiences that have never been tried before, engaging directly with our customers in the venue. Yeah, you'll see some of our branding around, but we're gonna have a QR code on the back of every single seat in that stadium. So 80,000 fans are gonna be able to interact with blockchain.com wallet, potentially with some exciting new things I can't entirely reveal today, but fan experiences that do everything from potentially airdrop NFTs to giveaways. We're gonna be hosting block parties and unique access to all kinds of exclusive content. And that's an interesting thing that the Dallas Cowboys wanted to explore too. New ways to have relationships with their fans. 10 years ago, almost every business was trying to figure out how do they use social media to have a dialogue with their customers. I think over the next 10 years, almost every major brand is going to be thinking about how they use crypto, blockchain technology, and NFTs to have unique fan experiences with their communities. And so that direction of travel has now started, and we're going to see some really interesting things built out from it.
It's interesting, after 11 years of crypto being a thing, 12 depending on where you put that starting point, that we still see such extremely hyperbolic panel names as our own. Blockchain will change everything. And I think that says something, right? Like, we, in 5 years ago, 6 years ago, when we saw a panel like blockchain will change everything, I think there was rightly some huge skepticism and red flags. And perhaps that skepticism still has a place today. Nevertheless, the sentiment that this is actually going to change everything in one way or another persists. And I'm curious what role you see the cryptocurrency industry as sort of evangelists, if you will, or teachers of these mainstream brands. Is there an example that you really are in love with where that is kind of singing?
Yeah, there are several. So I think most of us have grown up with the internet in this room, and so the sort of first version of the internet was a venue you could go to read stuff from centralized media sources like AOL or something like that. You could host your own application server and create an email account or something like that. Then we had sort of Web 2, which were things like Amazon and Facebook and PayPal and more. This Web 3 phenomena is a retooling of the internet to create new business models and new ways for individuals to exchange precious information over the internet. So when we say that blockchain technology and Web3 are going to change everything, what we're really saying is that the internet is constantly improving and it's going to continue to innovate and deliver on extraordinary experiences and change the way we interact with each other, change the way we exchange wealth, change the way we keep in touch with our loved ones. That's definitely been true and it's just accelerating. So over the next decade, it's my view that the internet will become the greatest and most powerful economy itself in the world. And we need to build tools to make it easier for all people to exchange precious information in that economy. And so in a lot of ways, there's some very specific examples because it's not always just about being on the internet too. Between the Dallas Cowboys example and in-game, in-real stadium, you know, fan experiences that are unique, there's a clothing company I know of called The Trace Collective that partnered with a company called Provenance.org to prove that all of the organic clothing they make is sourced correctly, that people are paid fair wages, so when you buy one of their articles of clothing, you can scan it and see a history of the proof points about that product in the real world. And that's an example of the internet and the retail world forging a path together. Just yesterday, Meta announced a partnership with Prada and several other luxury brands to build a marketplace on their platform so people can buy some luxury goods and show them on their online profiles. And just like when you were a kid, you might have collected seashells on Long Island or somewhere else, I think young adults are gonna collect all kinds of digital things, and it's gonna be really extraordinary to see what happens.
I think one caveat I want to throw in there when you mention Meta is, correct me if I'm wrong, but I do believe that in the nascent world of Web3, if it's not open source, if you can't build on it, it's not necessarily what we would consider Web3. How do you feel about that statement?
I'm sure they're having ferocious debates at Meta about that concept. And ultimately, the power of the Web3 community is really in collaborating on an open source internet-based platform and supporting interoperability. Meaning, if you buy some asset in one place, you can exchange it somewhere else and then trade it in a different venue. You know, these centralized platforms are built on surveillance, control over all your data, and closed gardens. I think they're going to have a very hard time competing in a world where people want to have more ownership over their data and be economically rewarded for sharing that data with different internet-based services. And so that's the kind of biggest change, is instead of the shareholders and the owners of companies necessarily benefiting the most, the actual users of the networks actually have an alignment of incentives to participate in those networks to be economically compensated. That is a huge foundational change in the business operating model for internet-based protocols and platforms.
If somebody is branding themselves as Web3 or Metaverse and you want to do business with them, but they don't have a code base on GitHub or somewhere else that you can go build on, be skeptical. I just would leave you with that little tip there. The core of Web3 is open source. What would you say is the most important thing about the nascent world of Web3, or if you want to bring in crypto generally speaking, that really has your attention right now that you think most of us are missing?
You know, I'll summarize quickly because we're going to run out of time. 10 years ago, I got involved in this industry because I thought that it was the most important place I could spend my time. Everyone in this room will be pursuing money for the rest of their lives. You want to earn money so that you can raise a family, invest in experiences, serve your communities, and maybe treat yourself once in a while. So reinventing our relationship with money and building money that serves the world and the internet at the same time, I think is one of the most powerful ideas that we can invest our time in. And so despite all of the things like the stadium and Web3 experiences and the rest of that, I think building tools that make it possible to broadly increase financial inclusion and build transactional systems that lower the cost of making payments on the internet is going to build a more efficient economy for everybody. And I know recently you were telling me backstage, you've witnessed this a little bit on a trip to Africa. I'd love just to maybe closing view on
that. I would happily wrap that up. I agree. I think that the core of the crypto value case is the ability for people to take control of their own finances, and not just as far as like where your money goes and how you spend it, but what you build. And I recently spent some time in Africa, specifically Kenya and Tanzania, and seeing these people that have been traditionally waiting for some outside investment and frequently being overlooked, taking matters into their own hands, writing their own code, getting their hands dirty, solving problems that only they can solve. It's really inspiring. And I would definitely encourage anybody who's into self-empowerment to get on those code bases, do some searching, and figure out what you can build on your own.
Yeah, we used to say, you can be your own bank. And I think that's a very powerful concept. And I'm excited to see all the work that's happening around the world on that. Thank you very much.
Nick, thank you so much. Please give a round of applause to everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to leave us a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. So until next week, see you then.